Hello, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Harry Mount, editor of the greatest magazine in the universe. And I'm delighted to have three fantastic speakers here today. But in the midst of happiness, we're in sadness because we have lost our very dear gentleman of the road, Wilfred Diath, who sadly died last week, aged 82. He was also a terrible old rogue who stole from church collection boxes and did a runner from countless hotels. But the point was, he was our terrible old rogue who stole from church collection boxes. And he was a fantastic columnist because he had the crucial element of a columnist of complete and utter honesty about his own terrible shortcomings. But he was a great, great friend to the oldie and a wonderful columnist, and I always try to print one letter saying, you must get rid of this disgusting man, and another letter saying he is an utter genius, and both were true. So he'll be much missed, Wilfred. We're also very sad in the oldie office to say goodbye to our dear friend Emily Steer, who is leaving the oldie, who has been keeping Oldie Towers alive for the last couple of years. But on a happier note, I can introduce you to the world's greatest, funniest MC, Mr. Barry Cryer. Yeah.
I've just noticed what was on the menu. Forced Yorkshire rhubarb. I'm from Leeds. Nobody forces us to do anything. Yorkshireman who loved his wife so much, he once told her. Now, I'm wondering already. Oh, I heard a thing on the radio the other day, Trump in Japan, and somebody mentioned Pearl Harbor. He denied ever meeting her. I ask our authors to bear with me if they're not aware of this. A lot of you are. Our convention, before I introduce them, the parrot joke. And as always, I say, if you're tempted to join in, please don't. It spoils it for the few who haven't heard it. Woman went into a shop and saw a beautiful gold parrot. And she said to the man, how much? He said, 20 quid, 20 pounds. He said, 20 pounds? He's gorgeous. He said, well, I've got to be honest with you, he's got form, he's got history. He was in a brothel, and to put it delicately, he's got quite an extensive vocabulary. She thought, 20 pounds, take a chance on that. And she took it back to the flat, and she took the cover off, and the parrot looked round and said, new place, very nice. And her two daughters walked in, and the parrot said, new place, new girls, very nice indeed. And her husband walked in, and the parrot said, hello, Keith. Now, our author writes of a chapter in history that remained for a long time a mystery, a chapter that, like a city, was erased in fire and darkness from, it was phased out from all contemporary accounts. The bombing of Dresden. His book amounts to a reconstruction of what preceded this. And no, I am no longer needed here, and so must I welcome our author now, Sinclair Mackay.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much, first of all, for inviting me to an oldie lunch, a very great honor. As nothing to the honour to be introduced by the great Barry Cryer as well, which is honestly a dream a dream come true, absolutely beyond imagination. And today I'm going to be talking, much like Dan actually, about the soul of a city, but a city which is synonymous now with the horrors of total war. But the subject is about more than that. It's about more than one night in 1945. It's more than one night of horrendous destruction. This is also a story about the power of art, the power of architecture, and the extraordinary capacity of the human spirit to regenerate and heal and move towards reconciliation. This is the story of Dresden in 1945. There's a line I always think of when contemplating that terrible night. When it comes, the landscape listens. Shadows hold their breath. Imagine, if you can, the early evening of February the 13th, 1945, in the city of Dresden. It's a cold, crisp evening, and the city is in complete darkness. It's the blackout. It's the wartime blackout. But even though the city is enshrouded in darkness, the streets are still busy and the streets are still full. There are German soldiers moving incessantly, moving across bridges, moving towards the railway station, moving towards the Eastern Front, which is barely 60 miles away, the Soviet army approaching ever closer. There are some factory workers still in the taverns, because on that day, February the 13th, 1945, it was a day called Fasching, Shrove Tuesday. By tradition, a day of carnival. And even that deep in the darkness of war, even just a few weeks before the end of the war, even with conditions being what they were, the children in the city that day had tried to keep up the traditions with their mothers and their grandparents. The children had been dressed up for carnival. They got the costumes out. There was one child dressed as Charlie Chaplin. There were some others dressed as clowns. There was one child dressed as an American cowboy. Extraordinary that that kind of iconography still could have persisted. But also, in the city on that evening, you imagine all these people moving through these darkened streets, the rural refugees fleeing from the onrush of the Soviet army, trying to negotiate their way through the labyrinth of this medieval city, this 18th century city. Imagine them looking up at all the spires and the domes silhouetted against that night sky. The dome of the mighty Frauenkirche, the Church of Our Lady, this beautiful 18th century extraordinary construction containing an amazing organ which had been played by Johann Sebastian Bach. You had the opera house built in the 19th century, which had been presided over by Richard Wagner, who'd premiered many of his operas there, and latterly by Richard Strauss, who had fallen out with the Nazi authorities, but had still been premiering his work there. This was a city not only filled with the most amazing art from Bellotto and Caspar David Friedrich, who lived there for a number of years, but also streets that had been suffused with music, this extraordinary culture. Music was part of the chemical composition of Dresden. The amazing cathedral choirs, whose piercing notes, even on that day, in February the 13th, 1945, could be heard coming from the Kreuzkirche. So imagine all of that. A city that had no suspicion at all of what was coming. The children, after all that carnival excitement, tucked up in their beds. Their fathers away, of course, on the Eastern Front fighting. Their mothers and their grandparents sitting huddled by radios, listening to the latest radio announcements, the fires ticking in the fireplaces. At around 9:40 p.m., the announcements started coming through on the radio. Alert. Alert, make your way to the shelters, make your way to the shelters. The air raid sirens started wailing, and out of a sense of weary dutifulness, all the people started moving down to these brick shelters. These sirens had wailed night after night after night, all the way through the war. But because this was Dresden, because this was a beautiful city deep in the heart of Saxony, surrounded by these rich, haunted forests, this kind of fairy tale landscape, the people of Dresden always imagined that they would be spared. They knew what had happened in Hamburg, they knew what had happened in Cologne, but they thought, not here, not us. They wouldn't. The Americans, the British, they love us too much. At 9:40 p.m., all these people made their way down to these ridiculously inadequate brick shelters, big brick cellars, basically. They weren't proper bomb shelters. Children on the edges of the town who were watching the first wave of bombers come over. The first wave of bombers carried the marker flares, these brilliant lights of red, green, and white falling from the sky. And to the children said afterwards that they looked like Christmas trees falling from the sky, these beautiful, lurid colors. These were the marker flares thrown down as a target into the heart of the city. And then the bombers came. Now, we know about the firestorm that Arthur Harris succeeded in raising, that Air Chief Marshal Arthur Harris was fascinated by fire and firestorms and burning the enemy. What they created that night was not just an atrocity, it was a phenomenon of physics. It bent the air, it bent the elements. If you were caught anywhere near it, you'd simply be sucked up into the air, into this tornado of fire. And as for those thousands upon thousands of people sitting in those brick cellars, again, I mean, you can simply imagine. But this is a story of such immense complexity, because you have to see it from, first of all, from the point of view of the people who were there. And the Dresden City Archives now has hundreds of personal recollections that they've quietly gathered over the years. It's an amazing, amazing archive, just extraordinary, extraordinary stories of those who witnessed and survived the horror of that night. But also I wanted to draw in very strongly the stories of the bomber crews, because as we all know, Air Chief Marshal Harris is a kind of byword himself for total destruction. But it wasn't him who was in those planes. He wasn't part of those bomber crews. I wanted to find out about the intelligent, sensitive young men who'd been flying deep into the heart of enemy darkness, night after night, with a courage that's kind of almost unfathomable, knowing that there was every chance that they too would be consumed in molten flames. I wanted to see it through their eyes as well. This, as the firestorm arose after two waves of 796 Lancaster bombers, a firestorm that rose a mile into the sky, a city razed to the ground that simply became an alien wilderness of molten ash and flesh. The other extraordinary thing about the story of Dresden, though, is what happens afterwards. How do people even begin to contemplate repairing their shattered lives after that unimaginable horror, having to not only find out how friends and family were, sort of seeking out loved ones, but also trying to restore some kind of civic order? They got the railways back up and running within two or three days. The postal system was back up and running within two or three days. That instinct towards order and civic orderliness was kind of there all along. But also, throughout the story, there are moments and flashes of kindness and human generosity, and that is actually the most devastating thing of all, I think. And it was recorded most strongly by Professor Victor Klemperer, who was one of the very few Jewish inhabitants of Dresden left on that night. Dresden had had a population of around 7,000 Jewish people. It was noted as being one of the most open and brilliantly cosmopolitan cities in Europe before the darkness of Nazism stole over it. By the time of the bombing on February 13th, 1945, that population of 7,000 was down to 198 Jewish people. All of them had been deported to death camps. Professor Victor Klemperer and his wife and all their friends knew it. He survived the night, and his wife survived the night. And the story, through his eyes, of how the city then rebuilt afterwards is absolutely extraordinary in its own right. At the end of the war, the Soviet army moved in. It fell within the ambit of the East German government, became that in the late 1940s. The GDR, basically, it moved from one form of totalitarianism to another. You lose the Nazis, but you get the Stasi and the oppression of Soviet rule. And yet, at the same time, throughout all this, the old instincts come back. That old instinct towards creating art, that old instinct towards creating music. And Dresden miraculously somehow starts rebuilding itself. So much so that the city you see today, if you ever get the chance to go, you really, really must. If you didn't know anything about the history of it, you wouldn't know that a single bomb had fallen there. It has been rebuilt so beautifully, so perfectly. And on a final note, I'll point out, I mentioned the Frauenkirche earlier, this amazing 18th century domed church, this extraordinary construction. It collapsed in the wake of the bombing. Its sandstone glowed a dull ruby red, and it just simply burst in on itself. And it lay unreconstructed for decades afterwards. The Soviets had no interest in rebuilding it. They just left this blackened stump in the center of Dresden. What had been the city's sacred heart was still lying there, broken. Recently, it's been rebuilt, partly with a little help from the Dresden Trust, a British charity, because as I said, this is about reconciliation too. I think they've contributed the Golden Cross at the top of this extraordinary, perfect, in every single detail, reconstruction. Now, you look at it, and you know instantly, because of the color of the sandstone, it's bright white, you know that this is a reconstruction. You're under no illusion that this church was only built, actually, in the last 10, 15 years or so. And you think to yourself when you're outside, well, this is surely fake. This is ersatz. It can't be the real thing. You step inside the Frauenkirche. You look up at that interior dome, so beautifully painted, with the saints in the rosy heavens in all their original 18th century colours. You look at the golden altarpiece and you listen to the choral music soaring up into the heavens. And you realise, no, this is real. This is absolutely real. This is a building that's full of love and vitality and soul. It's absolutely genuine, and it once more is the sacred heart of Dresden, and it symbolises, finally, a city that's come back to its true life. Thank you very much.